With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. We are in the prime season for berry harvest. So if you find yourself in the South Valley and would like to do some berry tasting, it's happening at Woodlake Botanical Garden, and they're inviting anyone to come join on June 10th from about 8 a.m. to noon, again, at the Woodlake Botanical Gardens. Leash dogs are welcome. Bring your kiddos, bring a hat, sunscreen, and a camera always for those good photo op moments. If you'd like to find out more information, you can contact Manuel Jimenez at 559-280-2483. And now let's get into today's show headlines. California backs plan to protect the Colorado River system. California, Arizona, and Nevada, which are part of the Colorado River Lower Basin, recently submitted their Lower Basin Plan to the Bureau of Reclamation, agreeing to conserve 3 million acre-feet of that Colorado River water from now through 2026. Colorado River Board of California Chairman J.B. Hamby says, quote, California worked hard with our basin state partners to achieve consensus among all seven states to protect the Colorado River system for the duration of the current guidelines. Hamby added, quote, California and our partners in Arizona and Nevada have developed a plan that results in better protection for the Colorado River system than other action alternatives identified in the current draft SEIS released last month by the reclamation. The Lower Basin Plan will generate unprecedented volumes of conservation that will build elevation in Lake Mead, make strategic use of improved hydrology, and build upon partnerships within and among states, urban water agencies, agricultural irrigation districts, and basin tribes who rely on and share the Colorado River. Each of California's Colorado River contractors and entitlement holders, including the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California, Imperial Irrigation District, Palo Verde Irrigation District, Coachella Water Valley Water District, Bard Water District, and the Fort Yuma Quechan Indian Tribe will participate in the conservation efforts. And now here's Brian German with more agriculture news.
Developing new strawberry varieties can be a bit of a balancing act. Breeder and field manager with the strawberry breeding program at UC Davis, Glenn Cole, said there are several factors they have to consider when bringing a new variety to market.
Fruit quality is really important, and obviously the fruit has to taste good. The California market supplies a lot of the fruit that goes throughout the whole country, so it has to be something that stores well and ships well. And so firmness and storability for shelf life is really important. And it plays into more so than just the fresh market, but there's all kinds of strawberry products that get processed, and that firmness really plays into it. And so all of those things are at play with these new varieties. So it provides them to have multiple purpose uses. There's a lot of varieties that can be really good for the fresh market, but then they soften up. And then as far as them going into the processing end of the market, those processors have their own lists of varieties that they like to take because they have better processing qualities. And so we're cognizant of that, and we're trying to address that with all of our future releases. And then ultimately, I mean, we're trying to improve sugar content. Sugar and firmness and yield are kind of negatively correlated. And so you get high sugar, you get lower yield, you get softer fruit. And so it's always a fine line of keeping the firmness there with the yield and have a berry that has good sugar and tastes good.
Several factors contributed to the low expectations for cotton acreage this year. President and CEO of California Cotton Ginners and Growers Association, Roger Isom, said it could be the state's lowest cotton acreage ever for a variety of reasons.
For 3 years, we've been praying for rain, and we got it, not only just in the form of direct rain, but in a huge snowpack, which for all intents and purposes is good, and it's hard to complain. The problem is we got so much that we flooded the Tulare Lake Basin, where we grow quite a bit of cotton. In some years, as much as a third of the cotton crop is in that Tulare Lake Basin. And then the second is it never stopped. They kept coming all the way into April, and to the point where it really delayed planting. And once you get past April 20th, hard to plant Pima at that point. If you do, you're going to hope for a long, dry fall so that you can get that crop back. If you don't, you're planting it, but you're going to see a reduction in yield. And I think when it came down to, you know, hey, it's May 1st and I don't have a crop in the ground, but I'm probably not going to plant. You know, some other things happen. Upland, which is something we can plant in a shorter season, price is, you know, less than 90 cents. So that's not very attractive. tomato price was up, so a lot of guys looked at planting tomatoes. And then other commodities, safflower and garlic, you know, prices are up and people are looking for growers to plant it or land to lease to plant it. So there were some other challenges that we might not see in a typical year or haven't seen in a while.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
You're listening to AgNet NewsHour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, you're not going to adopt soil health practices at the end of a gun barrel. Those words from USDA Undersecretary for Farm Production and Conservation, Robert Bonney, who says conservation efforts by farmers will remain voluntary.
Everything you will see from the Biden administration, from USDA on this, will be voluntary, incentive-based, collaborative efforts. Partnership's a perfect example of that, the Inflation Reduction Act dollars as well. We think that's an approach that can work. What we're essentially asking folks to do is voluntarily adopt conservation practices. Regulatory approaches aren't very good at getting people to, you're not going to adapt soil health practices at the end of a gun barrel. And so the approach here, we think the voluntary approach is absolutely the right one. But we need the data to be able to prove this, to demonstrate that this approach can work. So we're making big investments, both with resources in the Inflation Reduction Act and outside, to make sure that we can prove this up, that we have better numbers on soil carbon, that we have better numbers on methane, better numbers on nitrous oxide emissions. You know, if you think back a decade or more ago, everybody assumed it was going to be cap and trade. That's how we were going to do climate change. We're all trying to figure out what the rules are. The playing field is way more open right now. And we have an opportunity here to work in partnership with agriculture and forestry to develop things that will work for the climate and work for producers. Data is going to be critical, both to provide the information that producers need, but also to be able to look the public in the eye and look Congress in the eye and say, hey, these resources are providing real results.
Bonney says he's also aware of the early adopters who are already using the conservation practices the USDA is encouraging and wants to make sure they are recognized, not penalized.
So this is, it's really, really important that, this at the end of the day, tens of thousands of farmers have to make individual decisions about those practices they want to adopt. It's going to be local decision making. We can support that with data. We can support it with incentives. We also want to tap into your point about what farmers are already doing. We don't want to penalize the early adopters here. We need to provide incentives to keep those early adopters in the game to continue doing what they're doing. And a lot of the learning that that will take place is farmers talking to farmers, and we want to support that as well. It also means that partners are going to be really important. This can't just be a USDA thing. We have to work in partnership with folks on the ground that can encourage the types of conversations that can happen locally that will lead to greater adoption of cover crops or other practices as well.
Bonney also says carbon markets are part of the solution, but not the only part.
When we started the conversation that led to the partnerships for climate smart commodities, we did a lot of listening, right? And we think carbon markets could be one part of the solution, but not the only thing. You see a lot of interest from companies that buy commodities in greening their supply chain. You see producer groups, whether it's folks in cotton or beef or elsewhere, that are interested in marketing the climate smart practices that go along with their commodities. So I think at the end of the day, you're liable to see lots of approaches that seek to encourage private capital coming into agriculture to support climate solutions. Carbon markets may be part of that. Voluntary carbon markets, we know they're already out there. You have a compliance market in California. But I think those voluntary markets could be an important tool. They're likely not going to be the only thing. And so our job at USDA is to provide incentives, to provide data, to partner with folks in the private sector and in agriculture and forestry to allow those solutions to go forward. And the bet we're making is that this voluntary incentive-based approach backed by data, if we can prove that it works, the policy will a little bit take care of itself, whether it's a greater emphasis on carbon markets, climate smart commodities, supply chains, whatever it is.
That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And livestock producers eligible for assistance under USDA's Farm Service Agency Disaster Program will have more time to turn in applications, as the deadline has been extended for that disaster program. Here's USDA's Rod Bain talking with FSA Administrator Zach Duchesneau in this report.
Updates to USDA Farm Service Agency's suite of livestock disaster programs earlier this year led to this recent announcement by FSA Administrator Zach Duchesneau.
We've extended the deadline on these programs until June 2nd for 2022 losses.
Among the enhancements to the Livestock Indemnity Program, Livestock Forage Disaster Program, and Emergency Assistance for Livestock, Farm-Raised Fish, and Honeybees Program. Updates to ELAP based on severe winter conditions in the nation's northern tier.
Those enhancements will now help you if you had above normal feed costs, instead of just helping you with the freight to get that feed to the livestock. There are even circumstances where we can help you with the snow removal costs that you had.
In addition, horses maintained on eligible grazing land would be eligible under all three livestock disaster programs. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
And in more livestock news, NIFA helps veterinary medical students repay their loans. USDA's National Institute of Food and Agriculture helped 89 food animal veterinary practitioners with loan repayments from the Veterinary Medicine Loan Repayment Program in 2022. NIFA reported this week that 89 students from 28 American Veterinary Medical Associated Colleges received nearly $9 million in loan repayment benefits. The program offers up to $75,000 in loan repayments over a three-year period to help eligible veterinarians offset a significant portion of the debt incurred in pursuit of their veterinary medical degrees in return for their service in certain high-priority veterinary shortage situations. Funding is authorized by the National Veterinary Medical Service Act. NIFA National Program Leader Bob Smith says, quote, award recipients regularly tell us that they wouldn't be able to serve these areas without this support. The program helps address the critical shortage of food animal veterinarians in both private and public practices, particularly in rural communities throughout the United States. NAFB contributed to that report. And that's all for today's livestock news. This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
GMOs? Genetically engineered? Bioengineered? What's what? Well, GMO stands for genetically modified organism. It's the common term many people use for foods created through a process scientists call genetic engineering. And you'll start seeing bioengineered on some food packages to let you know the product or some of its ingredients come from GMOs. Feed your mind with more GMO knowledge on FDA's website.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
Help for organic dairy producers. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. The Department of Agriculture recently announced assistance for dairy producers with the new Organic Dairy Marketing Assistance Program. The program helps dairy producers mitigate market volatility, higher input and transportation costs, and unstable feed supply and prices that have created unique hardships in the organic dairy industry. USDA's Farm Service Agency is offering $104 million in grants to dairy operations to assist with projected marketing costs in 2023, calculated using their marketing costs in 2022. Organic dairy producers have faced significant and unique increases in their marketing costs, compounded by increases in feed and transportation costs and the limited availability of organic grain and forage commodities. FSA Administrator Zach Ducheneau says, without assistance, many organic dairies, particularly small organic dairies, will cease production. Eligible producers include certified organic dairy operations that produce milk from cows, goats, and sheep. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen. Water rights are a big issue in the western half of the U.S. A feedlot in Colorado recently discovered that it's important to use a water right properly. A cattle feedlot in Colorado had water rights for wells to be used for crop irrigation purposes. Eventually, the state water office discovered that some of the wells were used for the feedlot. The state water engineer developed a plan that required the feedlot to replace the water it had used from the wells for the feedlot from a nearby stream. A year later, the feedlot said that all was good because it was relying now on a new water source and didn't need the wells in question. But the state went ahead with its plan for the feedlot, and the Colorado Supreme Court said the state water engineer had the power to do what was necessary to implement its orders. That meant the feedlot had to replace depletions from pre-application pumping that continued to impact senior water rights and decreed conditional rights. The court also said that the feedlot had to pay the state's attorney fees and costs. In states where water is appropriated by priority and a permit system, it's critical to follow the terms of the permit closely. Not doing so can lead to significant fines, court costs, and fees. In the states of the Great Plains and the West, it's common that legislatures have delegated a good deal of authority to state water officials. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen.
Two new federal rural energy funding programs are significant, according to Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, as investments from the Inflation Reduction Act
is enabling the Rural Utility Service to advance the single largest investment in rural electrification since the Rural Electrification Act of 1936.
Almost $11 billion in funding. USDA's Rural Development, through its Rural Utility Service, operates these new programs. First, there is the Powering Affordable Clean Energy Program.
PACE provides loans, a portion of which can be forgiven, in connection with the development of renewable energy projects or energy storage. There are three categories of loan forgiveness that range from 20% to 60%, depending upon where a particular project is located. We'll be looking for wind, solar, hydro, geothermal, or biomass projects.
With $1 billion in investments available, then there is the Empowering Rural America, or New Era Program.
The Rural Utility Service will also be investing $9.7 billion through the new Empowering Rural America program. This program is exclusively for rural electric cooperatives. With the new ERA program, we're looking at low interest rates, grants that could be up to 25%, combinations of loans and grants, or loan refinancing or modification.
For eligible rural electric co-ops to deploy renewable energy, zero emission, and carbon capture systems. In terms of the application process for each program, first, with PACE.
We'll be accepting letters of interest in PACE from June 30th, 2023 to September 29th, 2023 on a rolling basis. And once a letter has been accepted, a more detailed application will be forthcoming.
And for new ERA.
The letters of interest for this program will begin being received from July 31st, 2023 to August 31st, 2023. Once the letters have been reviewed and accepted, a more detailed application will be forthcoming. This is an exciting opportunity for the Rural Utility Service to work collaboratively with our great partners, the Rural Electric Cooperatives, in order to advance a clean energy future for rural America.
Additional details on these new programs can be found online at www.rd.usda.gov/programs-services/electric-programs. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Why do we have GMOs? Actually, we've been modifying crops for thousands of years to prevent crop loss from pest and weather damage, to grow more food on less land, even to improve nutrition. Today, GMOs are developed for the same reasons. With genetic engineering, scientists can change and improve crops more easily and quickly. Feed your mind with more GMO facts on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
Grain traders are turning from planting progress to crop progress, and there is crop stress as we approach June. I'm Mark Oppold on the Bottom Line Report here at Midweek, brought to you by Superior Livestock. Parts of the western and central corn belts have not seen rain for the past 7 days, looking ahead to another 6 to 10 days of no rain and temperatures continuing to warm. And the warmer temperatures and dry weather will flow into and include the eastern corn belt as well. Traders holding heavy short positions going into this week already doing some short covering. That should allow for an extended rebound. How far? When we think December corn, longer term, into June can test 5.25 to 5.30. November soybeans 12.25 to 12.30, although selling in beans yesterday did not go unnoticed. Wall Street, so far, is betting on a debt ceiling deal getting done. They seem more focused on comments from J.P. Morgan CEO suggesting another 50 to 75 basis point rise in interest rates before the end of the year. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day.
Good day, everybody. Albert J. Hernandez, the Untamed Chef for AgNet West. Welcome to the California Kitchen, where you can learn how to cook from an award-winning chef. So my recipe today, especially on this hot day, it's 100 degrees outside, and I can't believe it. But it is summertime, and that's what happens when it gets hot. However, what could we do to help lower the temperature but not the flavor? Here is an awesome recipe for a pearl couscous pesto salad. Let's get untamed. Very simply, what we're going to do is we're going to make our couscous. All I'm going to do for this couscous is I'm going to take 2.5 cups of water. I'm going to add to that 1 whole cup of Israeli pearl couscous, and I'm going to add to that as well 2 tablespoons of butter, and we're just going to season our water to taste just so we have enough salt in there to help permeate the couscous and give it a good flavor. This usually cooks for about 5 to 6 minutes. Doesn't take very long at all to make your couscous go al dente. And once it comes to a hard boil, that's when you start that timer. So trust me on this one. It works great every single time. Now, making the pesto. Pesto is always tricky, but if you understand the basics of it, it is a very simple and incredible flavor to add to anything you're cooking. Now, all I'm going to add to this is 20 grams of basil, 52 grams of pine nuts, 70 grams of oil. You can use extra virgin olive oil. I prefer just using an olive oil blend only because the extra virgin olive oil is very, very strong. It's got a very strong bite to it, and you don't want that, especially if you're doing a really great pesto. You don't want to have extra on to that. And last but not least, we're going to do 1.5 ounces of Parmigiano Reggiano cheese. This is the really, really good stuff right here. Minimum age 3 years, and that's going to give you some of the most incredible nuttiness and flavor that you need for a great pesto. All I'm going to do is pulse that until everything is combined. I am not going to turn this into a paste or into an oil. I just want to have it combined together. I want it to be chunky. That's good enough for me. I'm going to let my couscous, once it's done cooking, and I chill it down, just hitting it with some cold water and then putting it into a strainer and putting a couple paper towels on that and put that into a bowl as well. And let that couscous cool down for at least a good 30 minutes to an hour. Then we're going to combine this with our pesto, and this is going to make for one of the most incredible pesto salads you've ever had, because that couscous adds so much flavor to this. Now, I've been asked before, chef, can we do this with tabbouleh and all these other different? You sure can, but for me personally, it's a texture thing, and I love being able to serve this kind of a dish with, you know, a beautiful piece of chicken or a nice fish. It goes so, so well. For this and many more of my Untamed tips, tricks, and all things, go to www.ajtuntamedchef.com. As always, this is Albert J., the Untamed Chef for Agnet West.
When I took a look at USDA's latest forecasts for U.S. and world crop production and prices for this upcoming marketing year, I thought I was sensing what I thought was a common theme song running through the whole thing. And I asked USDA Outlook Board Chairman Mark Jekanowski about it, and he said I was right, remarkably, this time. For once, there is a common theme this time.
Practically all of the major commodities, rice, corn, soybeans, we're looking at fairly big increases globally, in some cases also increases domestically as well, but larger supplies and prices coming down from the highs of last year.
So let's go with a sort of lightning round here, just taking U.S. crop forecasts. First, rice. USDA forecasting a rice crop 20% bigger than this last season, sending rice stocks up and USDA's rice price forecast down 9% to 1760 a hundredweight, but still
pretty strong prices for U.S. rice.
Now let's go to soybeans. USDA projecting a harvest of about 4.5 billion bushels.
That would be up about 234 million from last year.
Or about 5%. Now, the world is also busy producing a possible record large soybean crop, so U.S. exports are forecast down. U.S. soybean stocks expected to grow probably by over 50%.
Prices therefore coming down.
Down by over $2 a bushel for a season average price of $12.10, a decline of over 14.5%. Next, let's go to corn. Mark says the crop under so-called normal conditions should be about 15.3 billion bushels.
That would be a record that's up about 1.5 billion bushels from last year.
With a bigger crop, he says we should expect increases in the use of corn, including more exports, more use of corn for ethanol, more feed use. The world, though, is producing a record corn crop as well, probably. So just about the only number in the corn universe expected to be down in the next marketing year is, you guessed it, the price. And for U.S. growers,
we're currently forecasting the season average market price for the new crop year at $4.80 per bushel.
27% below this year's average. This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
Welcome back to the show. And now here's Agnet West Brian German with today's interview segment.
Dominic Rossini, NetFM USA, and the Agronomy West team leader.
And just a quick overview of what we were doing here today. I was fortunate enough to get a tour of your facility here in Fresno as part of the Almond Board Leadership Program. So what was kind of today about, and what were we able to take part in?
Yeah, so today's a unique thing that we started doing with our partnership with Bayer as well as with the Almond Board. Is with Almond Leadership, they want to bring them down and expose them to different parts of the almond industry that you wouldn't normally be a part of, right? So with NetFM, we are the world's largest irrigation manufacturer. especially for agricultural products. And so our facilities here in Fresno, California, which is unique, because we actually brought you guys down, got to go through a full tour of understand how drip irrigation is processed and built and made, and then also did some education on best practices, why you would choose certain equipment for certain regions, and how that would work, and especially how that becomes more efficient, and you can utilize your natural resources, water, fertilizer, plant growth to get the better production with less amount of inputs.
Is definitely kind of an interesting thing to see. I had not considered how complex some of these things can be made, but as part of kind of your presentation to the class, you were highlighting just some of the ins and outs of irrigation approaches, and one of the things you'd noted is pressure compensating versus non-pressure compensating in drip lines or just in your irrigation system. So I wanted to elaborate a little bit on what that means and what that kind of constitutes.
Yeah, so pressure compensating relates to there's a silicone diaphragm inside of a dripper. And what that does is as pressure is applied, it only allows a certain amount of water to go through. So if you're in a range between about 9 pounds to 60 pounds, your dripper and all the drippers around it that are pressure compensating will put out the exact same amount of water within a plus minus of a couple percent. Now, when you look at a non-pressure compensating, it's more like just a free flow. So it's still got the paths inside of it for clog prevention. But if you add pressure or decrease pressure, it's going to add or decrease flow. So when you look at what happened, like the first thing that was basically designed way back when was a non-pressure compensating because we didn't think about the silicone diaphragm, you know, in the 60s. So that takes a little more design. It's a little bit more for flat ground because as the ground has slope, you're going to try to counteract. So your pressures aren't very different between each different emitter. So they put out basically the same amount of water. So you get the higher uniformity. So that's going to be more of a flat ground process. Now, the pressure compensating, what that allows you to do is to want a lot more aggressive terrain, a lot more topography. It also, no matter if you're on a flat slope or just a slight slope, it really takes the guess game out of how much, you know, pressure you need to add, because if it's always above that amount, you will always, you know, be at the same flow. So your uniformity is going to be much higher. Now, the other thing we talk about is a lot of people have the idea that because there's a silicone diaphragm inside, that a pressure compensating emitter would actually be easier to clog. And that's opposite. Because pressure compensating emitters, because of that diaphragm, are actually designed to open and flush if debris gets in there, or to bounce the diaphragm, which is called a self-flushing emitter. So actually, they are harder to plug than a non-pressure compensating emitter. So that makes them even more durable or more tolerant. And in NetFM, our pressure compensating drippers are, for especially almonds, are actually only an 80 mesh, which means you don't have to filter as hard because they have such a large path, and the flushing works if you ever need it, that it'll always keep clean and allows you to have more efficient system.
And you'd noted there's pros and cons to each of these, and it's going to kind of depend on your individual operation. And part of that conversation was looking at micro sprinklers as well. And you'd noted that they're not necessarily designed to catch up, but if you have that good baseline of water there in your irrigation, micro sprinklers can be a good option as well, and specifically in orchards.
Yeah, so any micro system, so it doesn't matter if it's a micro sprinkler system or if it's a dual line or single line irrigation system, all micro systems are designed to maintain and work through peak ET. So if you get behind, meaning you weren't irrigating enough early part of the season, as you get in the latter part of the season, they're not meant to catch up that water, which means you could stress your trees harder, which hurts not only that production, but hurts the fruit wood for next production. So what you want to do there, and most people do this, is you want to pre-irrigate or irrigate a little harder in the beginning of the season to build up that reservoir in the soil. So that way you have more water under there, that baseline, so the tree can draw on that as it goes forward. Now, uniquely like a year like this year, we've had so much rain that you really don't have to pre-irrigate because we're getting rain all the way into April, which is really February through March-ish is where you're going to build up that aquifer underneath, just underneath each tree. So That's one of the things you have to keep in mind when you're using drip irrigation and micro irrigation systems, is that you need to have that little bit of early on water, which helps.
And also one thing that was pretty neat, just kind of going as part of the tour here, was the Uniram XRS and kind of the involvement of copper as part of your system there. Kind of give me the Cliff Notes version or the abridged version of kind of how this works and what the development is there that makes it pretty unique from what I can tell.
Yeah, it is a very unique product. So basically it came about as we've had our farmers, especially almond, asking us, how can we have a variable drip product and that the roots won't attack? And so the thing is that copper, or cupron is what we inject into ours, is roots do not like copper. And so when they come in contact with it, they'll pull away from it. So if you have a copper on your drip line and the roots contact it, they'll pull away from it, which will prevent strangulation, also prevent them going down inside the emitter and doing plugging off that way. So the uniqueness of it is that there's a copper stripe all the way down the product. And then inside the emitter, there's also copper. And that is not just painted on, it's actually impregnated into the plastic. So it's not going to dissipate or go away. It also has the same UV protection as everything else. So if you want it above soil before you bury it. And so it's designed to go for almonds and other nut trees to be buried at specific areas. What we prefer is 3 feet out from the trunk on each side, about 4 to 6 inches of cover on top of it. That's it. That way it's easy accessible if something does strike it, but it's out of the way of all of your equipment and the roots aren't going to go and penetrate inside of it, so you won't have that problem. But it gives you all the benefits of having a clean floor and being able to work around, as well as during harvest put on some water, when your machinery's going, everything else. So that way you get all the benefits and the trees are happier and you can work more efficiently.
I know that's been one of the kind of common concerns with subsurface irrigation, and as what's that going to do with the roots invading? But you noted as part of your presentation to the leadership class of anything that you're making available here has several years of research and trial work and stuff behind it to show that it's achieving what it's designed to achieve.
Yeah, it's one of the things I really enjoy about NetFM is that we will hear from the customers of what they want. We take it back to our corporate. We design a product, but they don't just design it in a lab and say, okay, it's ready to go. We do field testing. We do extensive field testing back in Israel. It comes out into whatever market it's supposed to be in. We'll do another couple years of field testing before it ever gets fully released into the market. That way we have the confidence behind it that it works. Two, we also have other growers that they use their practices. So it's not us telling you what works. We know it works by just general practices that most growers use. So it allows it to fit into the market, fit into what you need, and it's going to do what we tell you, and you're going to be happy with it and get many years' life out of it.
And just lastly here, you'd noted kind of your many partners that you guys work with is Bayer, and you have something called Precise Defense, and just kind of want to highlight what that idea or program is about.
Yeah, we're corporate partners with Bayer, and in the U.S. we brought out a program under the West Coast for almonds in particular, which is Precise Defense. They have a chemical called Vellum, and it's to fight nematodes in the soil. And what you can do is you can inject it directly through our irrigation system, so you don't have to worry about spray rigs or other pieces of equipment going through the field. You're already utilizing it. So it allows it to go penetrate down into the soil, and then it will kill off the nematodes, which increase livelihood and better production for the crops. And then also in that program, so if we agree to do that, it's a NetFM turnkey program, and you sign up with Bayer and you get $40 an acre for the product. So that way it makes the product virtually free the first couple of years you use it in order to really reduce your nematode problem and benefit to having a great irrigation system as well.
Thanks, Brian. And stay tuned as we'll have more of the day's agriculture news and farm features here on the AgNet News Hour. Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search our name of AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet West. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Irrigation in arid California is as complicated as it is essential. Unpredictable supplies, uneven distribution, complicated application schedules, and regulation make it a challenge. No wonder help with water is the biggest request at USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service. Since 2014, NRCS has invested over $100 million helping over 1,000 California farmers conserve water. By using superior technology and savvy management, farmers get more crops with fewer drops. Join the Water Savings Club. Contact your local NRCS office. NRCS, helping people help the land since 1935.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now. California's Crop Progress and Conditions Report. For the week ending May 21st, weather continued to warm and there was zero changes to the state's drought conditions. Roughly 95% of the state is considered without drought or in a region coming out of drought. Reservoir levels, with the exception of Trinity Lake, were at 71% of capacity or greater. Farmers across the state kept an eye on grape buds and clusters. Grapes were sprayed for weeds and mildew. Peach orchards were thinned and sprayed for weeds, and harvest began for apricots and early peach varieties. Citrus varieties continued to be picked and packed, while other seedless varieties were netted to prevent pollination. Kiwi growers were placing bee apiaries in their groves, and dates continued to ripen. Cherry growers began harvesting in some of their orchards. olives were treated for nematodes, apples were sprayed for fire blight, and picked strawberries and blueberries could be found at roadside stands. Thanks to the warming weather, nut growers were able to catch up on fertilizing and weeding their orchards. Pistachios, walnuts, and pecans continued to mature. Some pistachio growers started small plant bug treatments to protect their nutlets from damage, while almond growers treated their orchards for nematodes. Sacramento Valley farmers were winding down asparagus harvest, and the cherry tomato crop was reported delayed a few weeks due to late planting because of the wet conditions. In Stanislaus County, tomatoes and sweet potatoes were transplanted into fields. In San Mateo County, Brussels sprout fields were fumigated. And down in Tulare County, cucumbers, zucchini, watermelon, cantaloupes, and leafy greens were planted. Sweet corn, eggplant, okra, peppers, and garlic were growing on well. Onions and zucchini plants began to bloom. If you'd like to take a look at this full report, visit nass.usda.gov.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture seeking both cooperative and contribution agreement proposals to help carry out conservation efforts. USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service in California will make $1 million available for each agreement opportunity. Each of the agreements have a floor amount of $25,000. Cooperative agreements will have no funding match required with a ceiling of $75,000, and contribution agreements will require a one-to-one funding match and have a ceiling of $150,000. The six target resource concerns include air quality, plant productivity and forest health, water quality, wildlife habitat, water quantity, and soil health and soil quality. Emphasis will be given to projects that provide direct technical assistance to NRCS staff in the implementation of Farm Bill conservation programs. Proposals for each of the opportunities will be accepted on grants.gov through June 3rd. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media, at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.